You are listening to This Week in Palestine. Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, April 26th, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear tonight belong solely to our hosts and guests. They do not necessarily represent the views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. You're listening to This Week in Palestine, a place where truth does not arrive timidly, where it is not trimmed, softened, or reshaped to soothe the powerful. Here, truth steps forward with its full weight. Here, urgency is a pulse, not a choice. Here, clarity is a responsibility, not a luxury. Wherever you are driving through the long stretch of night, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting quietly in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to join us. I'm your host and narrator, Bethany Marks. On this program, we do not sand down the edges of reality. We do not rewrite the story to make it easier to swallow. We do not exchange honesty for comfort. This is a space where truth arrives unfiltered, where resistance is lived, not imagined, where solidarity is not a slogan, but an inheritance carried through generations, where the voices rising from occupied land are not faint, not isolated, not swallowed by the machinery of empire. They rise together steady, unbroken, standing alongside movements across the world that insist on dignity, justice, and liberation for all people. This hour is more than a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding shattered homes to unbroken hope, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the ember of defiance refuses to go out. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, struggle, beauty, and humanity. We do not soften. We do not dilute. We speak with intention because the stakes are far too high for anything less. This Week in Palestine is not a sanctuary for polite avoidance. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. Because the struggle for liberation does not belong to one land, one people, or one moment in time. It is shared. It is global. And it is sacred. And now, we turn to a conversation that has been circulating widely, an interview on Redacted News titled Professor John Mearsheimer, Trump's Only Option is Surrender. In this episode, hosts Clayton and Natalie Morris sit down with Professor John Mearsheimer, one of the most influential political scientists in the United States and a leading voice in the realist school of international relations. The discussion centers on the escalating conflict between the United States and Iran, and the increasingly narrow set of choices facing the Trump administration. Mearsheimer begins by outlining what he sees as the core problem. According to him, the United States has effectively lost its war against Iran, not through a single catastrophic event, but through a series of strategic miscalculations. He argues that the U.S. entered the confrontation with unrealistic expectations, believing that pressure, sanctions, and military threats would force Iran to capitulate. Instead, he says, Iran has adapted, hardened, and expanded its regional influence. The conversation then turns to the role of Israel and its leadership. Mearsheimer discusses reports that Netanyahu and Mossad chief David Barnea persuaded Trump that a shock and awe bombing campaign could topple the Iranian government quickly and decisively. According to the interview, this advice contributed to a strategy that has now backfired, leaving the U.S. with fewer options and greater vulnerability. One of the most striking parts of the episode is Mearsheimer's analysis of the Strait of Hormuz, a narrow waterway through which a significant portion of the world's oil supply travels. He explains that the ongoing naval blockade and rising tensions in the strait are not weakening Iran. They are sabotaging peace negotiations, including talks reportedly taking place in Islamabad. The blockade, he argues, has become a symbol of a failed strategy, costly, dangerous, and ultimately ineffective. Throughout the interview, the hosts emphasize their platform's mission to cover stories they believe mainstream media ignores. Clayton Morris, a former Fox News anchor, and Natalie Morris, formerly of MSNBC and CNBC, frame the conversation as part of their broader effort to challenge dominant narratives and bring forward perspectives that are often sidelined. By the end of the episode, Mearsheimer delivers the conclusion that gives the video its title, that Trump's only viable option in this conflict is to accept a negotiated settlement, what the hosts characterize as surrender. It is not a moral judgment, but a strategic one. In Mearsheimer's view, the United States has reached a point where escalation would be disastrous and victory, in the traditional sense, is no longer possible. This interview is not simply about geopolitics. It is about miscalculation, influence, and the limits of power. It is about how wars begin, how they spiral, and how leaders confront the consequences of their decisions. And it is a reminder that in international politics, the most difficult choice is often the one that requires stepping back rather than pushing forward. But the most important reason for bringing this episode to you is that it raises a deeper question about who is truly in control and who is shaping the direction of American policy. It invites us to think more critically about power, influence, and who ultimately gives the orders. Let's listen.
Well, President Trump told CNBC, yes, the stock market news channel this morning, that he's ready to go back to war against Iran. Bombs will fall, he told Joe Kernan. Watch.
A lot less lethal a long time ago.
So to be clear, you're saying that you need at least the prospects for a signed deal today and tomorrow, or else you would resume bombing Iran.
Well, I expect to be bombing because I think that's a better attitude to go in with. But you know, we're ready to go. I mean, the military is raring to go. They are absolutely incredible. You know, I built the military in my first term. I'm using it now. The military, when I took it over from Barack Hussein Obama, it was so depleted, so sad. And I built it in my first term. You remember those big numbers. You talked to me about it once. That's a lot of money for military. I built it. We did a great job with our military. And we're using it now and rebuilding it, too. We've done a lot of rebuilding also in my first year of the second term. But yeah, we have a tremendous rhythm.
So that's great. So I built this thing that we have to use it. We have to use it to bomb other countries. That's what we have got to do, is just build it. We got to use it to bomb other countries.
If you
right
build
now.
It, they will come.
So that's great news that we're going to be using all of these bombs that he built up. So that's great. J.D. Vance's trip to Islamabad is on hold now. We're learning that as talks appear to be off for now after Iran demanded the U.S. lift the blockade of certain ports. So the Iranians were not even going to show up to this to begin with. And there's so many moving parts right now as this, we're sort of counting down here as the ceasefire looks to be wrapping up and bombs about to fall. So who's holding all the cards here? And who's going to blink first in this. Professor John Mearsheimer is the author of How States Think, The Rationality of Foreign Policy. Of course, also the author of one of the greatest books I've ever read, which is The Israel Lobby. It's a must read, and I think everybody should read this book if they want to understand how Washington is completely sold out to the Israel lobby. And the professor is joining us for the very first time here on Redacted. Finally, a pleasure. We've been trying to think get you on for about a year and a half, but every time we reach out, you're in an airport. So great to have you here, Professor.
Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's our great pleasure. So who do you think blinks first? It seems like we are winding down with a few hours left here. We're at this brinksmanship moment here. Does Iran blink? Does the United States blink? And who do you think holds all the cards?
Well, I think it's not in America's interest to go back to war. I think we have a deep-seated interest in negotiating a settlement here. And the reason is, if we go up the escalation ladder, which is effectively what going back to war would mean, the Iranians hold the cards, not the Americans. President Trump can talk about how powerful the American military is and all the wonderful things that he thinks it can do. But nobody can tell a plausible story about how escalating this war, whether with ground forces, naval forces, or air forces, produces a favorable outcome for us. So I think we have a deep-seated interest in negotiating some sort of settlement. And for that reason, I would be surprised if President Trump doesn't work out some sort of arrangement to keep the ceasefire in place and facilitate negotiations in Islamabad. I would actually be surprised if he attacks Iran. I wouldn't be completely surprised, because who knows for sure exactly what's going on in his mind and in the back channels as well. But my sense is that we're not going to go back to war.
And so what we're seeing is rhetoric that continues to repeat. And that's why you see the memes now about Groundhog Day. And so, you know, can the president spin it in a way that gets him out of bombing, or will it just be what seem to be the initial strategy, which is inflict suffering on the Iranian people through attacking their infrastructure so that they demand Iran bend the knee?
I think he can spin it for two reasons. One is the public is overwhelmingly against this war. I don't think the public wants to see the war start up again, or the shooting start up again. But the second thing is that the markets look good when President Trump is talking peace. And when it looks like war is about to start up again, the price of oil shoots up and the stock market goes down. So I think it would be reasonably easy for him to spin this in a positive way, even if we would conclude, if we looked at it carefully, that it was him backing off, not the Iranians.
I mean, this morning you had, before you jumped on, I played the soundbite from Trump on with Joe Kernan this morning on CNBC, on which is a stock market news channel. It would have only been one stage worse if he went to Bloomberg TV and did this announcement that he expects more bombs to fall on Iran. And as soon as he made that announcement, the price of Brent crude oil skyrocketed once again on that announcement. So why do you think he chose, like, going on a business news show in the morning to make this proclamation?
I'm actually surprised that he did. I do think that he believes that talking tough will coerce the Iranians into coming back to the negotiating table, number one, and number two, making concessions once they get to the negotiating table. He thinks he has a lot of leverage. He thinks that this military instrument that he has is a big stick that will produce a lot of successful results if he wields it in an effective way. And I think he's wrong in that regard. And the mere fact that every time he talks about going back to war, oil prices rise and the stock market falls tells you that those two institutions understand full well that going back to war doesn't make sense.
A lot of White House insiders, Tucker Carlson among one of them, has said the president didn't really want to do this war. He acted when he acted in person like he didn't want to do it, but he had to do it anyway. So what do you think are the forces pushing him to continue to say this Do you think it really is about a nuclear weapon, or is there something else?
Well, I think that the New York Times has written two big articles on the decision-making process, and the second of those two articles in late March, which was based on extensive interviews, pretty much lays out the story. And it's quite clear that President Trump was convinced by Prime Minister Netanyahu and the head of Mossad, a man named David Barnea, that if he used military force in conjunction with the Israelis in a shock and awe campaign where we decapitated the regime, this would lead to the almost instant collapse of the Iranian regime. There would be a popular uprising from below, and the end result is that some kind of regime would come into place that would dance to our tune. President Trump really believed, I think, that we had a war-winning formula. We could win a quick and decisive victory. What's amazing to me about the whole process is that almost all of his advisors told him that this was not a good idea. And some of them told the president, including the head of the CIA, that they were fundamentally opposed. And General Kane, who is his hand-picked chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told him that we had no war-winning strategy. Nevertheless, President Trump went ahead, and he went ahead in large part because the Israelis bamboozled him into thinking that he could win a quick and decisive victory.
I know. It seems I keep reflecting on your book, The Israel Lobby. It seems like you have these advisors that have surrounded the president and in large part have been telling him this is a nightmare. So what voices do you believe he's listening to that he believed that it was going to be a quick march in, they would kill the Ayatollah, and this thing would wrap up in 4 days?
Well, he listened to the Israelis. He listened to the head of Mossad. If you read the Israeli press, there are all sorts of stories that say that David Barnea, the head of Mossad, basically lived in the White House, that he spent so much time in Washington trying to convince President Trump that a shock and awe strategy would finish off the regime and lead to a new regime that was attuned to our interests. And of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu, for him, attacking Iran is his Moby Dick. It's been an obsession with him for about 40 years, and he's been beating President Trump over the head for ages now to go in and finish Iran off. And I think they were able, those two, and a lot of Trump's advisors as well, who are closely tied to Israel, like Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, surely helped in the process to convince President Trump that we had a war-winning strategy. And of course, we didn't. People like J.D. Vance and John Ratcliffe, the head of the CIA, were correct.
Now, what happens, though, since you've studied the Israel lobby so acutely? They got their way. They got the war they wanted. It is not playing out well for Israel on the world stage. So in your, I guess, estimate, what will they do next if they've lost global public opinion and they've lost this war? It seems like that despair could be equally dangerous.
Well, I think in terms of global public opinion, that doesn't really matter to the Israelis. I think if you look at their behavior during the genocide, it's quite clear that they don't care what the global public thinks. I think what's much more important is where we are in this war against Iran. What President Trump is trying to do is to shut down this war. He wants a settlement. And the reason that he wants a settlement and he's willing to make compromises with the Iranians is because he understands that there is a real danger that the global economy will go off a cliff. And President Trump, therefore, has a deep-seated interest, to put it mildly, in ending this war as soon as possible. But the Israelis do not want him to end the war because the Israelis understand full well that we have failed to achieve our objectives in this war. It's really quite remarkable when you look at what's happened over the past 50-plus days. The United States and Israel started off with four clear goals. One was regime change. Two was to do away with Iranian missiles. Three was to get Iran to stop supporting Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Hamas. And then four was to eliminate Iran's nuclear enrichment capability once and for all. We've achieved none of those goals. And indeed, we've created a situation where Iran now controls the Strait of Hormuz, which it did not control the day before the war. That would be February 27th. Huh. So we have effectively lost this war. And what the Israelis want us to do is not quit, but to restart the war and try to achieve those goals.
When you look at the Strait of Hormuz, because you brought it up, there's a lot that you said there I want to unpack over the next few questions here. But the Strait of Hormuz blockade, you've said, is not only ineffective, it's counterproductive. The United States basically admitting, or President Trump, that we'll have sort of a permanent presence there. How does that help the United States at all?
Well, what happened here is we tried to get a ceasefire. And two of the key elements in that ceasefire were, number one, the Israelis would stop bombing Lebanon, and number two, the Iranians would then open the Strait of Hormuz. And this past Friday, we had a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in place, and the Iranians indicated that they were going to open the Strait of Hormuz. So it looked like all the elements of a ceasefire were in place, and that would facilitate the discussions that were supposed to take place today and tomorrow in Islamabad. But what happened is that President Trump, and I do not understand why, said that he was going to keep the U.S. naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz in place,
right,
which in effect is saying that he's going to keep the blockade on Iran in place. Unsurprisingly, the Iranians turned around and said, we're reclosing the strait. Right. And that helped. And if you look at why we're not going to have this meeting today or tomorrow in Islamabad, it's in large part because the Iranians insist that the United States end its blockade of the strait. So President Trump, if anything, has undermined any chance at this juncture of a meaningful negotiation to end this conflict. It's just hard to understand what he was doing. And by the way, I would add that one of the reasons that we did not have a blockade on the strait before last week was we wanted that Iranian oil out in the global oil market to keep oil prices down. We were allowing the Iranians to ship oil through the Strait of Hormuz because we thought it was in our interest to have that Iranian oil out in the market. But once you go to a blockade of the strait, a U.S. blockade of the strait, that oil no longer comes out. And if anything, that just undermines our position from an economic perspective. So all of this behavior by the president just does not make any sense to me at all.
Yes, but a couple weeks ago, we had Professor Mirandi on the show, and he recommended a book called Going to Tehran, by actually their American foreign policy experts, talking about the decades of reneging on détente. Is that how you say that?
Détente.
I only read it with Iran. And this is consistent with what the Clinton administration did to Iran, with what Obama has done to Iran, ignoring them, pulling the rug out from under them. They have made sincere efforts to make negotiations. So this is really a it's an extension of the uniparty. Why have we done this for so long? Are you able to sort of see a puppet behind this nonsensical behavior?
Absolutely. If you read the chapter on Iran, we have a whole chapter on Iran in the book on the Israel lobby, that's Steve Walt and I, and we lay out in great detail how the Iranians moved at different points over the years, especially in the 1990s, to develop some sort of rapprochement with the United States. The Iranians understood that it was not in their interest to have a permanent hostility with the United States. And of course, President Clinton, as you'll see, understood that right off the bat, and he wanted to move towards some form of rapprochement. But what happened is the lobby moved in and told him that was inexcusable. He just couldn't do that, that Iran had to remain the devil incarnate. And that's been the case for a long, long time now. And as I say, you want to remember that for Prime Minister Netanyahu, Iran is his Moby Dick. And that means for the lobby, Iran is Moby Dick. And the lobby and Israel work hand in hand to make sure we have hostile relations with Iran, even though Iran is not a threat to the United States. It's very important to understand that. The idea that Iran is a threat to us makes no sense at all. It just isn't.
I saw Piers Morgan getting into it with you the other day because he's arguing that they fund Hezbollah. Your argument, of course, is that, well, that has nothing to do with us. That has a direct connection to Israel. And why are we involved in it to begin with?
Well, also, may I point out that Hezbollah originally wanted a relationship with the United States, and George Bush said no. And they did not, in fact, want to align themselves with Iran. That was plan B for Hezbollah.
So I guess Professor Netanyahu now has, it seems like he's given up trying to take on Hezbollah head on. They tried it against, it seems like they keep trying this and it keeps failing. And now is trying to really create like a civil war inside of Lebanon. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the Israelis went into Lebanon in 1982 and then they left in 2000 with their tail between their legs. They had a devil of a time occupying Lebanon, which is why they left. Then they went back in 2006, and it was a quick and decisive defeat for the Israelis, and they pulled out of Lebanon. And here we are with the Israelis back in southern Lebanon and having a devil of a time dealing with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And furthermore, they continue to bomb Lebanon, but they can bomb Lebanon forever and ever, just as they bombed Iran in the recent war and in the war last June. But do they produce a victory as a result of all that? No. Is Hezbollah defeated? No. Is Hamas defeated? No. Are the Houthis defeated? No. Is Iran defeated? No. The Israelis believe, like many Americans do, that you can use military force to solve what are essentially political problems. And sometimes you can do that, but not often. And there's no way that the Israelis can deal with the Hezbollah problem or the Hamas problem without a political solution. But they refuse to develop some sort of policy, some sort of political solution for dealing with these groups. And instead, they think they can just pound them into the ground. But it just hasn't worked very well. And in my opinion, it's not going to work well.
I was going to say, stay right there. We have a bunch of more questions for you. We're going to take a quick break, grab some water. We want to ask you about war crimes, particularly U.S. Ambassador Mike Walls announcing on Meet the Press this weekend that, you know, bombing infrastructure, you know, civilian infrastructure, bombing roads, bridges, hospitals, and otherwise is essentially part of the game, seems to be fair game now in this war. I want to talk about that. Plus, all of these refineries that have been going up in smoke, get your sense of the global oil shock and what's in store for the...
All right, breaking news. The White House just published this statement by President Trump saying, based on the fact that the government of Iran is seriously fractured and upon the request of Iranian authorities, we have been asked to hold our attack on the country until such time as their leaders and representatives come up with a unified proposal. And so I have just directed our military to continue the blockade. But otherwise, we're going to hold off on this whole let's bomb them to fit. So Professor Mearsheimer joins us today. And what do you make of this pivot where he said on the news, we're going back in, can't, you know, they didn't show up. And now he's saying they came to me. They're in shambles. They need some time to get their ducks in order. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what President Trump just said is consistent with the point I made early in the program. I think despite all his bluster, he is not interested in going back to war against Iran. And I think if you listen to what you just read, I think it's an artful explanation for why he backed off. He's putting the source of the problem on the Iranians. He's saying the problem here is that they can't figure out what they're doing because the left hand and the right hand are not working together. And he, being the generous leader that he is going to give them time to work out a position. And then they can go from there and hopefully they'll be able to negotiate an end to the war. So he is, you know, in a very crafty way, getting himself out of the mess that he got himself into with all his bluster.
So I've often asked the question, but what is the off-ramp for President Trump in this situation? Are we seeing now maybe the pieces of the off-ramp starting to be built here?
It's hard to say exactly what the off-ramp is, because there are probably about 7 or 8 big issues that have to be solved. A lot of the focus is on the nuclear enrichment issue. First of all, we don't even know what the deal is regarding nuclear enrichment, but there are a whole slew of other issues that have to be dealt with, like the question of who controls the strait, what's the future of U.S. military bases in the region, what sort of security architecture are you going to put in place to convince the Iranians that they're not going to be attacked again, what are you going to do with reparations, what are you going to do with sanctions. I could go on and on. There are just a lot of big issues. Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis, and Iran's relations with them. So all these elements have to be worked out to get some sort of meaningful agreement.
Well, so also, it's weird because the president today on CNBC specifically said that using force is his greatest sort of cudgel in this, you know, to use bombs, use the threat of bombs. That's how he can get them to come up with a unified proposal. That's how he can get them to come to the table. And now he's basically admitting that, well, they're too fractured. We're just going to step back and allow them to come up with something on their own. I don't understand.
It's so funny when you put it that way, because who buys that? Like, oh, yes, grand and merciful.
Well, we get them to negotiate through killing them. That's how it works.
But you want to, this is not to disagree with you for one second, but just to reinforce your point, you want to remember that we started this war and we bombed them heavily for a long, long time, and we did not succeed. If you look at where we are today, we have not achieved any of our goals. And for me, that means so far we have lost the war. And President Trump seems to believe that even though we've lost the war by bombing them up to now, he can now restart the bombing. And for some reason, it's going to do all these wonderful things that it was unable to do from the start of the war up until the recent ceasefire. And of course, this is a foolish argument. We have no military option here. It's just very important to understand that. And actually, if we begin to escalate, I believe that plays into the hands of the Iranians. I have long argued that if I were playing the Iranians' hand, I would not have gone to Islamabad. I would not be talking about going to Islamabad in the next couple of days. I'd say to the United States, go ahead, up the ante, go up the escalation ladder, and let's see what happens to the international economy. And as the international economy, which I liken to the Titanic heading towards an iceberg, gets closer and closer to that iceberg, I think Iran's leverage will grow by leaps and bounds, and they'll be able to get an even better deal than they would get now. But the fact is, President Trump is not playing the strong hand here. He is playing a remarkably weak hand here. And the problem he faces, again, is that the Israelis don't want him to end the war. The Israelis understand that we have lost, that we have not achieved their goals, and they want him to continue, President Trump, that is, they want him to continue pounding Iran to escalate. But Trump knows that that is not a war-winning formula.
Here's this meme that this is J.D. Vance. This has kind of gone viral. This is from the Iranian embassy in Indonesia, put out this meme of President or Vice President Vance just standing there waiting.
It's a Mr. Bean meme.
Yeah, Mr. Bean meme.
And so they did exactly what you said, not last week, but this week. They no-showed. They didn't show up.
Yeah, they weren't going to. And so to save face, they basically said, well, we're not going to send J.D. Vance. We're going to put a pause on that. Otherwise, he'd be sitting in an empty room.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, as we were talking about before, the problem here is the U.S. blockade on the Strait of Hormuz, which is effectively a blockade on Iran. The Iranians are insisting that we take that blockade off. And my guess would be that President Trump will work out some sort of arrangement over the next couple days so that the blockade is taken off, the U.S. blockade is taken off, so both sides can come to Islamabad and begin to negotiate. But you want to remember, as I was saying before, there are a whole slew of issues that have to be settled here before you can shut down this war. It's not like there's just one issue, which is nuclear enrichment. And even in the case of nuclear enrichment, that is a really tricky issue. So I think it's going to take something of a miracle to get any kind of meaningful agreement, especially when you consider that the Israelis and the lobby here in the United States will be doing everything it can or everything they can to undermine any agreement that President Trump tries to come up with.
Well, let's talk about the economy. You brought it up, and I want to talk about the oil shocks. And we had Professor Pape on the show yesterday, who's made the argument that things have accelerated now for this, you know, global catastrophe in a way that maybe we didn't anticipate before. But and now we're also going to see, of course, the fertilizer troubles, the food shortages and potential famine problems. Here's just a few minutes ago, oil prices once again go back down. They went up, they skyrocketed this morning, and then they plummeted after the president just announced this extension of the U.S. ceasefire. But let's just talk about the global economy right now and where you see things playing out, both for the United States and, frankly, for Europe, which seems to be on the edge of disaster.
Well, just to talk about the Gulf itself, about 20 million barrels a day normally came out of the Gulf, and the world economy needs about 100 million barrels a day. That's where the 20% figure comes from. We make the argument that 20% of the world's oil comes through the Gulf. So that's 20 million barrels out of 100 million barrels. I would estimate that somewhere on the order of 9 to 10 million barrels are now getting out, which means that somewhere between 10 and 11 million barrels are bottled up there. And furthermore, there's quite a bit of oil, Saudi oil, coming out of the Red Sea. And the Red Sea is on the other side of Saudi Arabia from the Persian Gulf. So if we ramp up the war, right, if President Trump goes hard after Iran, what's going to happen here is that the amount of oil that comes out of the Gulf will be close to zero. And furthermore, the Houthis and Iran are almost certain to shut down the Red Sea. And given all the damage that's been done to the international economy so far, if you take into account what would happen if the Gulf is completely shut down and the Red Sea is shut down, you're talking about the Titanic eventually hitting the iceberg. Wow. This, again, is why Trump can just not go up the escalation ladder. When you talk about what Bob Pape was saying, Bob was talking about the situation today in light of the fact that some oil is still coming out of the Gulf. And a lot of oil is coming out of the Red Sea. That's where the Saudi oil is coming out. So the situation is not as dire as it would be if we shut down the Gulf completely. So that's the oil and gas story. With regard to fertilizers, roughly one third of the world's fertilizers come out of the Gulf. And the fact that fertilizers are so important for providing food for people all around the world, especially in rather poor countries, shutting off the flow of fertilizers out of the Gulf is going to have disastrous consequences. Huge numbers of people are going to starve to death. Furthermore, it's quite clear that helium is not coming out of the Gulf that is absolutely essential for developing microchips. Aluminum, the Gulf is a big provider of aluminum. That's been cut off, the flow of aluminum out of the Gulf. Furthermore, jet fuel and diesel fuel has been cut off in serious ways. And there's talk that that in Europe, they only have about 6 weeks left of jet fuel for their airplanes. So the consequences are already quite stark. And as you move forward, it's just going to get worse and worse. And that's assuming that we don't attack Iran. You want to remember the argument that a lot of people are making today is that President Trump just has to solve the problem right away. In fact, he should have solved the problem yesterday, just so we can begin to repair all the damage that has been done. Well, if that doesn't happen and the status quo remains in place, you're just going to have more and more damage. This is the point that Bob Pape is making. The additional point that I'm making is if you go back to war, the situation gets even worse because the Red Sea will be shut down, the Gulf will be almost completely shut, and we will really be in deep trouble then economically.
You know, someone in the chat says, the cup is half full with the professor, because you seem to be indicating, yes, this is bluster. He can't really do it, and he knows this. And yet he has escalated in some quite terrible ways, starting, like you said, with, a war bombing a school of young girls. So can we account for the fact that it seems very illogical, but he's done it anyway many times when it always seemed illogical?
Well, there's a difference between starting the war and then escalating. He started the war thinking that he was going to win a quick and decisive victory. This is when that tragic mishap took place where those young girls were killed. But he was under the impression that he could win a quick and decisive victory early on. And then when he didn't win a quick and decisive victory, there's no question he escalated because he thought that increased bombing, more and more bombing, would bring the Iranians to heel. But that didn't happen. And then he moved to a ceasefire. And he has not been that reckless since then. He has not been anxious to go back to bombing. And what he did, in fact, was turn to the Navy. You want to remember that militaries have three instruments they can use to either coerce or defeat an adversary in combat. One is the Army, one is the Air Force, and one is the Navy. And what President Trump started with was the Air Force and naval aircraft, right? That's what he started with, air power. And that didn't work. And there was talk that he would go to a ground invasion, but he's not gone to a ground invasion, and he's not going to go to a ground invasion. He just doesn't have enough combat forces in the region. Plus, he doesn't want boots on the ground. So air power failed, no ground power option. And what did he turn to? He turned to the Navy, and he turned to this blockade. That's the real coercive leverage he believes he now has on the Iranians. It's the blockade. But the blockade is of limited utility. And that's why he's talking about going back to bombing. He's not saying I can keep the blockade on and the blockade is a war-winning weapon, because it's not. And there are all sorts of complications associated with the blockade we haven't talked about that illustrate this. But the point is, he's now talking about going back to bombing, which he hasn't done for a few weeks now. And the reason he hasn't done it for a few weeks now is it doesn't work. And the reason I don't think he'll go back to that is because it won't work. It'll just make a bad situation even worse. He has no military solution here. He can't bring the Iranians to accept his demands with military force. And that's why he has to negotiate. And in fact, he's playing a losing hand. So he's going to have to make some major concessions to the Iranians. And again, as I keep emphasizing, the problem he faces, the reason he's in so much trouble, is Israel and its minions in the United States will go to enormous lengths not to let him make a deal with the Iranians.
Well, you just took the words right out of my mouth, because I'm thinking, as you're making all these great points, there's one huge variable sitting at the table, and that is the Israelis. And we heard from the head of Mossad just a week or so ago saying we will not end this war until we have full regime change in that country. And then, of course, the courting of President Trump through Mossad and making sure that they are carrying out their plans. So what about the Israeli variable in all of this? Will they allow President Trump to not stop bombing?
Well, look, they will go to great lengths to do that. And I think the fact is that President Trump is likely to reach a point where he feels he has no choice but to play hardball with the Israelis in ways that no U.S. president has ever done that. And the reason is that if he doesn't play hardball with the Israelis and tell them that he's going to take a deal with Iran and they just have to swallow that fact, then the international economy at some point is going to go off a cliff. This just can't go on and on and on. Something has to be done to shut this war down. That means the Israelis cannot get what they want. Again, what the Israelis want here is, was clear from your comment regarding what the head of Mossad said, is they want regime change. Well, good luck. If anything, this bombing campaign has reinforced the regime's position inside of Iran. And it's caused a rally around the flag effect. So regime change is much harder now than it was on February 27th. How are we going to get regime change? We're going to unleash the dogs and tear Iran apart? We're going to wreck it as a civilization? I don't think so.
A few weeks ago or a week ago, I think you said that President Trump's only solution here is surrender. Do you think that that's still the case?
I think that he basically has to concede defeat, and he's going to have to accept most of Iran's demands. I think that he will be able to get the Iranians to make certain concessions, because the Iranians will conclude that if they get enough concessions from the United States, it makes sense to not prolong the war and cut a deal. But what exactly those concessions look like is hard to say. If you ask me to describe what a likely deal looks like, how you deal with all the different elements are on the that are on the table, I couldn't really do that. I don't know, you know, what Trump is willing to give away and what he considers important. I think the big issue for Trump, and I think for the Israelis, is the nuclear enrichment issue. I think if Trump can get a deal on nuclear enrichment that looks like a great improvement over the JCPOA, the JCPOA, of course, was the 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran. If Trump can get a much better version of the JCPOA, he may be willing to concede on a number of other points, such as the fact that Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz moving forward, and it can put a toll booth in place, and it can use the money from that toll booth to take care of reparations. I mean, something along those lines. And then Trump will have to concede on all sorts of issues like the missiles, support for the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah, and so forth and so on. But there's no way we're going to come out of this looking like we won. Right. We'll get a concession or two, I believe. And I think we'll get a concession or two on the nuclear enrichment issue. But we won't win. We will not win, in my opinion, a complete victory on the nuclear enrichment issue. The best that I think Trump can do is get a deal that says, where he can say it's better than the JCPOA. But we've lost this war. We started a losing war.
Yeah. Wow.
Philip has a question.
Yeah, Philip on our team has Go ahead, Philip.
So my big thing, like, and I think like one of the other factors that's not really come up very often is like, at what point does the rest of the world decide that this is an act of war against them? Like, how long are people going to sit there and let the U.S. destroy the global economy? Like, there are other countries out there. It amazes me that they're allowing it to happen. Like, yes. At what point does everybody else step in and say, all right, you're done?
Well, you're absolutely right. The rest of the world is shaking in their boots. There's just no question about that. This is why I believe the Chinese and the Russians put pressure on the Iranians to go to Istanbul. It's why the Chinese have been working with the Pakistanis. They're both close allies. They've been working together to facilitate negotiations. The Chinese and the Russians and every other country on the planet understands that if we hit the iceberg, we're all finished. It would be a total disaster. It'd be like the Great Depression, worse than the Great Depression in the late 1920s, 1930s. You can rest assured that there is a tremendous amount of pressure being put on President Trump by other countries to shut this war down. I have no doubt about that. But the problem you want to keep in mind is that the United States is an incredibly powerful country, and it's pretty much free to do whatever it wants. And President Trump is the kind of leader who doesn't care that much about what other countries say. As I like to point out, he is a supreme unilateralist. He is not someone who's interested in multilateralism or working with allies or working with institutions. He does what Donald Trump thinks is the right thing to do. And that makes it difficult for foreign leaders to convince him to alter his behavior. Because, again, he's so powerful and he is so inclined to act unilaterally and not really take into account the interests of others. But I think it's become clear to him, and I think it's become clear to all his advisors, that we run the serious risk of tanking the international economy. You'd have to be blind not to understand that that threat is out there. And I think that threat is what will get him to cut a deal at some point. And again, the problem he'll face is Israel and the lobby.
And I think you'd also be blind not to see all of these oil refineries around the world that are going up in flames. It seems like many of these oil refineries are BRICS-aligned oil refinery countries, whether in India, Russia, and other places, although we've seen some of these oil refineries going up in flames in Texas and other places. But I just don't believe in coincidences, Professor. And you see, I mean, I think we're over 10 of them now, maybe even like 12 of them now, up in flames. What do you make of all of these oil refineries, one of which was about to be inaugurated by Modi in India, like celebrating the launch of this brand, and then it blows up the day before?
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't heard this story. Tell me more about it.
Well, that's really all we know. It's just that you have oil refineries in Pakistan. One just went up in flames today in Pakistan. You had yesterday in India going up in flames right before Modi was about to inaugurate it. You have this Russian one that's up in flames. You have, I think, in Romania. I mean, the list is growing by the day. And it seems to me intentional. When you take out the infrastructure of many of the BRICS-aligned countries, sleeper cells, I don't know. I mean, but my mind, you know, I just don't believe in coincidences, and all of these things are going up in flames within the last 2 weeks. It, you know, makes no sense to me.
Well, the only thing I know about, I mean, I'll have to look into what you're talking about, but the only thing I know about is that the Ukrainians are very interested in attacking Russian oil refineries.
Yeah, which they did in the past 24 hours. So they hit a massive one in Russia. So that's just one of like 12 that have now gone up in flames in the past 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, the Ukrainians are very upset with the fact that President Trump has taken sanctions off of Russian oil, because President Trump wants Russian oil, just like he heretofore has wanted Iranian oil out in the global market to keep the price of oil down. So the Russians are selling lots of oil these days and making out like a bandit. And the Ukrainians, needless to say, are very upset about this. And what they want to do is attack Russian oil facilities and do that with drones. And they have been somewhat successful in that regard. But I hadn't heard about all the other refineries that are blowing up.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just don't believe in coincidences. Oh, and it's very fascinating what's happening suddenly with all of that. But, Professor, it's been a real pleasure to have you here on the show. We hope you'll come back. We hope we were...
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to dim, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that so often tries to smother it. I'm Bethany Marks, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour rooted in clarity, dignity, and a solidarity that does not disappear when the headlines shift or the cameras look away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or opened a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, and your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. And to the extraordinary team whose labor keeps this program alive. Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Abby Masri, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tani Abu Moza, Dr. Rana Awad, Professor Yara Rashid, Juliet Salome Olivier, Renaud Al-Ghul, and our editor, Muhammad Al-Ghul. Your steadiness, your clarity, and your devotion are the heartbeat of this show. Week after week, you remind us that storytelling is not merely craft. It is inheritance. It is resistance. It is care. It is memory carried forward. This Week in Palestine is produced by Truth and Justice Radio, broadcasting proudly for more than two decades from WZBC, student radio at Boston College. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Listen Notes, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Visit www.millionpodcasts.com to explore their growing library, including ours. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine from the river to the sea. شيل عالجمال شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله نسهر على نجوم الليل انا لا ويلو شيل عالجمال شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل انا داويله شيل عالجمال شيل يا حوط طب الله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليله ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل انا داويله. My national aspirations, you respect them, do you? I see. Well, the way you would respect them is by getting out of my land. That would be the best illustration of how much you respect my national aspirations. I find you fascinating, Mr. Diane. I really do. I can't understand how you have such self-assurance. A man who was born in Argentina, whose family comes from the Ukraine, and is actually wanting people, sensible people, to believe that he has some connection with my country. But there's another point I want to put to you, since you respect me so much. Tell me, to many people, you, despite your eloquence, represent nothing other, you and your fellow settlers, nothing other than common thieves. You live on stolen land, you drink stolen water, you eat stolen fruit, you farm stolen farms. Convince me and the audience and the viewers that you are not, you and your settler friends, are not common thieves. شيل عالجمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من
ونسهر على نجوم الليل نداويله شيل شيل على الجمال يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل يا ليلى ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا داويلة شيل شيل عالجمال شيل يا حوط طب الله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلة ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا داويله